Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Attention BetMGM customers. Have a friend who loves sports as much as you do? Here's a chance for both of you to earn a $50 bonus when they sign up through BetMGM's Refer a Friend program. Just sign into your BetMGM account and click on the Refer a Friend program to send your friend a message inviting them to register a new account in the same state you use BetMGM in. Once your friend signs up and makes a deposit, they'll receive a $50 bonus. And once your friend places a bet with their bonus and the wager is settled, you'll receive a $50 bonus as well. Share the excitement and get a $50 bonus every time you refer a friend to BetMGM. Visit BetMGM.com for terms and conditions. Must be 21 years of age or older to wager. Ohio only. New and existing customer offer. All promotions are subject to qualification and eligibility requirements. Rewards issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets. Bonus bets expire in 30 days. Please gamble responsibly. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Your cousin from Boston.
New Sam Adams Wicked Easy is light and wicked easy to drink. Which means it's wicked easy to call up some buddies for a little day sesh. So, wicked sorry I'm late. Sam Adams Wicked Easy.
The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Drink responsibly.
At Lowe's, we're your go-to for great gardening values every day. That's why we've lowered our price on select bagged mulch, now starting at just $2.88 a bag. Mulch helps prevent weeds and retains moisture. And when you put it down around trees, shrubs, and flower beds, you'll see how beautiful it makes your outdoor space. Just in time to welcome back family and friends. Shop online and pick up in store. Lowe's, home to the best part of summer. Selection and product availability vary by location. While supplies last, U.S. only. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
All right, it's film study, and this week we're going to look back at kind of what happened this past weekend where we all watched Ed Reed's really long induction speech. So we're going to talk about Ed Reed and his career. Ken, Michael, how you guys doing?
Life's good, Josh. How about you?
I'm doing good. I'm in a hotel again away from my family, which is my just how this summer's going. So I can't wait till Friday to be back with family. Michael, how's things for you?
Oh, I can't complain, man. I'm doing great. Sorry to hear that. I know what that can be like sometimes, so hopefully you get back to them soon.
Oh, it also meant that I got to skip out and miss on the movers packing everything up in Maryland, and I also missed the movers unboxing everything in Florida.
So, oh, darn.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the wife and kids have had to take care of everything, but it's all right. I'll be back there at the end of the week, and then we'll have our family back long term. So, all right, guys. But we're not here to talk about me and my schedule. Let's get to Ed Reed and one of the coolest busts the Hall of Fame have ever put out.
Was definitely a cool one. That hair is out of this world. And honestly, there's just his face looks completely like him. I didn't think the Ray Lewis bust was nearly as depictive, as accurate in terms of what his facial features are.
Yeah, no, this Ed Reed bust, man, they nailed it. And I was wondering, you know, sometimes what sort of part of a player's career they're going to take that look from, you know, are they going to take it from a younger part? Like with Ray, they obviously took it from a younger time. I honestly don't know where they took it from, right? But with Ed, it's like, this is, you know, what he looks like right now, which is cool with, you know, all of the hair with the, I mean, you can't see the gray obviously in the bust, but you can just tell that's him right down to a T. That's his look, that cool, that suave kind of demeanor. I mean, they really captured it.
Boy, Ed Reed had a weekend to remember in terms of the event itself. He set the record, I'm told, by a few seconds for the longest speech ever, and it didn't last long. It only lasted two speakers until Tony Gonzalez busted it by two more minutes. So Reed was longer than Favre, but Gonzalez was longer than everybody. And the new record's up to 39 minutes. My guess is they won't hold it there. We're almost getting to the point where we need, I feel like, Academy Award music or one of those old style shepherd's crooks to pull these guys off the stage. And it keeps
increasing, like the player contract market, right? One guy gets, you know, highest paid player at a position, and then immediately a couple of months after, there's a new next highest paid player. So I think you're right. If we don't have something to sort of give them the wrap it up sign, the sort of cue music, the record's just going to keep getting longer and longer. There's not going to be any end to it.
Yeah. I mean, they could get a wave, but unless there's some or else to that, there's not going to be any stops to a lot of these things. Or you know, they can make them practice it. I thought it was actually funny that Eisen said in advance that he was coming with some remarks prepared, some not prepared. So we'll see what happens, kind of thing. And it did seem like Ed, you know, obviously very emotional, very fun speech. He's not trying to be politically correct in any way with regard to football, although he was incredibly politically correct with regard to other things, politics.
Yeah. And he gave some indications in some interviews and stuff that he did before the weekend that he might touch on some political topics. You know, he has some views on some of those things. But yeah, when it comes to football, you're going to get, and we got what you always get. Right. I mean, we probably will touch on some of these stories. We had some of that here in Baltimore at times, especially when Harbaugh first got the job. So he was who he has always been. And I think that's one reason why he's so beloved among the fan base and really across the league. I mean, it's not just the Ravens fans, obviously. I mean, I think across the league, he's extremely well respected and extremely well thought of. And I don't think you get too many arguments for best safety of all time. You hear some things every now and then, but I really don't think you get too many who will contradict you on that too strongly.
It's the Steelers and the Eagles fans. They all have we've all got our individual guy, and you can't tell the Eagles fans anything. You really can't tell the Steelers fans either anything. I thought it was funny that he took an immediate dig into the Bengals and Browns, said thanks for the 30 picks. And that's the kind of thing. It was only 22, by the way, but that's exactly the way that line sets up. Is you know, Reed claims he had 30 picks against these guys, and they have to come back. It's only 22. What are you talking about? And he goes, oh, I'm sorry. It was only 22. So he gets to restate, you know, what was going on. It's a pure Ed Reed moment. The entire weekend, I saw a picture of all of the Hall of Famers who were just inducted with their jackets, and everybody's dressed up very nicely. And Ed Reed has got a different dress code he's involved in. Look, it's not like he's not cool. He's very cool, but he's just at a different dress code. He's taking it down to business casual or even casual with a yellow jacket on, and everybody else is dressed up as if they're you know, they're going to prom or something. It's kind of funny anyway.
And he can pull it off. You know, everybody can't pull that look off. There's some people who would try to do that in that kind of setting when it kind of feels like it's not appropriate to do it. But then other guys who just are that way, that's their essence, they can pull that look off anywhere. Like, it doesn't matter, you know, what else is going on. I mean, right down to the cigar in hand, you know. Yeah, so
how about that?
Only he
unlit most of that weekend. Walking around with that thing, it's just it's like a Groucho Marx affectation almost that he's carrying around to go back a few years, obviously.
Yeah, but, I mean, only Ed Reed, man. Only he could pull that whole look off, and it's not contrived. I mean, this is him. You could just see him. You could, you know, imagine just visiting him on any random day, and that's what he looks like. He's got a cigar in hand, backpack on. You know, that's just him.
All right, well, let's go ahead and talk about Ed Reed's career again, because we're really, really are excited to have this show and talk about it. We're a few days later than we were originally hoping to record. That's okay. Ed's career is worth talking about at any time. So we've got a mailbag out there, and we've asked people to put in their comments, and we'll make sure we try and get to as many of those as we can at the end. But going back to 2002, when the Ravens were first scouting Ed Reed, obviously, there were a lot of questions. At the time, I think a lot of people didn't think a safety was a good guy to take in the first round. This was just not something worth taking, using a first-round pick on. But he had towered over college football. He had 21 career interceptions at Miami. He went back for his senior year after he had 8 interceptions as a junior. I can't even imagine anyone doing that today.
No, and absolutely not.
He's drafted number 24. Other Ravens greats were drafted ahead of him in the first round, specifically Bryant McKinney at number 7 and Dante Stallworth at number 13. So I think the Ravens did okay bargain-wise.
Yeah, I mean, you look at what kind of career resulted from that pick, absolutely. And it's interesting you say that about how, you know, there was really kind of the argument at the time that maybe the value really wasn't there at that position, at that particular pick. And we still hear that argument today, you know, about, you know, taking safeties in the first round. But his pedigree in college, you mentioned it. I mean, I don't know that it matters. Like, when you have that kind of production,
right,
you got to take that player in the first round. You know, this is so rare.
You do. And I think it's generally accepted now that there are certain positions where you have to use a first round pick if you want a Hall of Fame talent. And free safety is one of them. And yeah. So... you know, Derwin James, who admittedly is a strong safety, Ed Reed also started off as a strong safety, won his DPOY there, but he is a guy that a lot of people said, including myself, that you have to draft him if you get the chance to get him in the first round. And you know, he's in that group, and Earl Thomas was in that group, and so are others. But Ed, a great value at 24, just in his rookie season. He only missed 7 snaps as a rookie. Of course, he came in after that cap purge following the 2001 season when the Ravens let a lot of contracts go, and they can thank Elvis Gerback and they can thank Leon Searcy for contributing mightily to that. But purge was probably going to be necessary anyway. But the really interesting thing was how many defensive players got their first opportunity in 2002 along with Reed. We had Marcus Douglas, Kelly Gregg, Kimo Yatu, Anthony Weaver, Bart Scott, Adalis Thomas, Gary Baxter, and Will Demps. They all got their first significant playing time in that year. Scott had 57 snaps, so I'm kind of cheating on that. Maybe he's not significant playing time that year. But, you know, that's a major component of the 2003 through 2006 defense in that group.
Yeah, I mean, that really was, in a lot of ways, some of the core, you know, foundation, core building blocks of that great sort of defensive legacy that was to come. And it's ironic how it happened, where, you know, you're purging the team and kind of established guys who are on the team, and you're looking at it like, you know, what are we going to do? You know, you're losing these established players, but then these young players all come in and get some playing time, and, you know, you don't know, nobody, maybe you knew, I didn't know at the time that these guys were going to help be a part, you know, help build and be a part of what this defense turned out to be over the next couple of years. But this is a good reminder. I think it's a good lesson to keep in mind when teams go through these kinds of purges, that, hey, sometimes there's a silver lining. Sometimes there's not. Sometimes it's just a salary dump and you're going to be in purgatory for a while. But sometimes there's a silver lining to it.
Well, there's a story there for the 2019 Ravens, who are in the same position with a bunch of guys leaving in their free agency year, and maybe the 2020 Ravens as well, that there are a lot of players they need to replace. And while it's terrible to lose Mosley and it's difficult to lose Weddle, although they certainly have a replacement there that's at a similar or even greater cost, and it's hard to say goodbye to Sizzle after all these years, you got a hell of a group of players coming along behind them and a bunch of draft picks that are very exciting and will get us excited for this preseason. A little bit more about 2002. Let's talk about that. So just in week four on that Monday night game, which turned the Ravens season around, they were 0-2 at that point. They came into that Monday night game. A lot of people remember Chris McAllister going off for the 107-yard missed field goal return. And they remember that it's Todd Heaps coming out of party and that maybe even that Chris Redmond started that game for the Ravens. This was before Blake took over for him. But Ed Reed blocked his first punt in that game as the only blocked punt of his career. He didn't return for a touchdown, but did set up a score. And he also had his first interception off Brian Greasy in that game.
Talk about a coming out party. the thing that I remember a little bit about that game was I do remember the block punt. And I remember it immediately made me think about what he did in college. Like he sort of done, you know, sort of did a similar thing where obviously he was a great safety and a great defensive back, but played on special teams, not just on punt block or, you know, kick field goal block teams, but also returned punts. And was a really good punt returner. And I know we'll probably talk about this as we go through, but in addition to all of the interceptions, in addition to all the great plays that he made on defense, he was a heck of a special teams player, but just too valuable to have back there as, you know, an every time punt returner. It's kind of a special situation punt returner as his career went on, but was a really, really good special teams player.
Right. He became a designated fair catcher. And a lot of teams have that. They have one guy who's better at catching the football in the air and is less likely to drop it. And they put him back in certain situations in that way. And then, of course, couple times he did go off. He went off on one return against Minnesota. He went off on another return in the game against Cincinnati, the opener in 2007, for a touchdown, put him ahead. It's just I always expected something very special when he was back there, but it was usually a designated fair catch. I want to talk a little bit about his third career interception, which occurred in 2002 against the Bengals. Is at home, and he reached his hand up and prematurely celebrated going into the end zone, had it knocked free for a touchback that gave the Bengals the ball back. And what I remember most about that was people at work complaining about Reed the next day. And I thought, you know, he's the best player on this defense. Ray Lewis was hurt at that point, by the way, but he was the best player on this defense right now. You know, if you're upset with him, you know, we're in a lot of trouble here. And that was something that seemed to follow him the rest of his career, was he was just too loosey-goosey with the football after an interception.
Yes, the many lateral attempts, we heard coaches, both Billick and Harbaugh, sort of bemoan those. But I think they understood that was part of his greatness, right, is that you were going to have to take a little bit of, I wish that he wouldn't have tried to lateral that ball, or I wish he wouldn't have tried to sort of reach the ball out before he got in and scored. But sometimes with great players, you have to allow that sort of breadth for them to really express their full greatness. And sometimes it's going to cross the line and get, you know, from greatness into sort of riskiness. But ton more great than risk with the way that Ed played. And he was looking to score on defense, right? Every time he got the ball in his hands, he was looking to score. And if he saw that maybe he wasn't going to be able to finish with a score, he was going to get it to somebody else who he thought could.
Yeah, very much so. And Ed, you know, one of the things about looking at like stolen base statistics or the number of times a guy gets thrown out at second base after a single, you need to realize that if you're not getting thrown out at all on those opportunities, you're not taking enough chances, because you should have some failures on the margin, because there's going to be lots of success on the margin. And believe me, taking the ball out of Kyle Bowler's hands between 2000 or, you know, Jeff Blake in 2002, but taking the ball out of Bowler or McNair's hands from 2002 through 2007, I'll take that entire range. I'll say was not a bad thing. And in fact, it was something that I think Billick came to realize. Haloti Ngata intercepted a pass in his first NFL game in the wipeout at Tampa Bay, 27-0 to start the 2006 season. And what he said about Haloti Ngata is that he got down to the 9-yard line with a 60-yard return on that interception. He said, he's got to find a way to get in the end zone there. And he was exactly right. The Ravens had to settle for three on that field goal. They got the ball to the 9-yard line. But Reed understood that, and he should have been taking risks to get in the end zone. I think he did a good job of it, and I generally think Ed Reed got paid for the risk he took.
Yeah, and he talked about that on an interview I heard him on over the weekend, that during that time in particular, the time span that you mentioned, that they weren't good on offense. And so he really took it upon himself to find ways to try to score. He said, look, if we didn't, there was a good chance that either they weren't or they were going to be kicking a field goal, and you can't trade threes for sevens. And so his mindset really was a defense, a defense that wants to be a championship caliber defense. It's not enough to take the ball away. You've got to convert it into scores.
Yeah, completely agree. Let's move on. I've got other notes for 2002. It's a great season, a wonderful rookie season. Actually, one of my favorite seasons as a Ravens fan, to actually see that team, after being wiped out by the Purge, to still make a really good run at the playoffs and have that very disappointing loss to the Browns the second to last week of the season. But anyway, we'll move on to 2003, when the Ravens took over again as the best defensive team in the league. Reed had 7 picks. He blocked another punt, the one that everybody remembers, that triggered the rally against the Seattle Seahawks at home in that remarkable 44-41 comeback win.
Yeah, what a game. What a game. I went back. I think I told you before the show, I went back to look at some games on Game Pass, and they only go back, I think, to like 2010, 2009 right now. But then obviously you can go to YouTube and watch highlights and go back even further. So, yeah, just going back and reliving some of those highlights. And then they kind of had a little bit of an extended highlight of that particular game, just the scoring and the back and forth. I mean, that I didn't remember it until I watched the highlights, and did kind of trigger some stuff. And I'm like, man, what a great game. Yeah. I know I was supposed to be focusing on him, but I was like, this is such a great game.
It's one of the great games in football history. It had everything. It had an enormous mistake by the officials that kept the games alive. It had great play, the great play by Reed on the punt block. It had a great play by Lewis to pull the ball away from Max Strong. It had Dilfer coming in the game for 2 plays and helping the Ravens in the overtime. It had Hasselbeck throwing for 5 touchdowns, no interceptions, and still losing that ball game, which is just incredible to me still. So, wonderful game. We don't need to talk exclusively about that. Yeah. The Ravens, obviously, that year were carried by Jamal Lewis on offense, and that's really all they had. They had Kyle Bowler, who was awful. They had Anthony Wright, who wasn't a whole lot better, but he got to keep the reins even after Bowler was healthy and came back. And it was really all about that defense being the best individual unit in the entire league and carrying the Ravens to the playoffs that year. So exciting year, and Reed right at the heart of it, of course, defensively.
Yes, Ravens fans, younger Ravens fans, don't ever forget. Right. If they look at the current quarterback situation, or even the last couple of years of Flacco, you've got to have perspective. If you think things are bad, just think about and listen to some of these names that we're throwing around as we do this recording, and then just go look them up. Go look them up and watch YouTube and see what was going on back then. Be thankful for what you're seeing right now. Be thankful for what you saw with Flacco. I'm telling you, this is what we've seen. This has not been the overwhelming, sort of part of history in terms of quarterback play with the Ravens.
Yeah, the Ravens went a long time before they found their franchise quarterback in 2008. So, that was quite difficult. So let's move on to 2004. Happy times, because Ed had one of his finest seasons. And you can say that. He won the Defensive Player of the Year award, a little out of position still at strong safety. He played his first 3 years in the NFL there before he moved to free safety in 2005. And that was really the point of switch. You can see it in his tackle totals, that he made a lot of plays around the line of scrimmage, did a lot of run blitzing off the edge in his initial years. That was always cool to watch, because he had a great sense of when he could come off the edge, and he just always was pretty good about reading keys from that running back, and potentially also from a fullback if they were using it to make a tackle in the backfield.
Yeah, I can remember some of that vaguely. Specifically though, and I was looking at this again, the timing of that, he just had such an innate sense of when to time his blitz. So like you mentioned, coming off the edge, but I also saw a couple sort of coming off the ball, right? And sort of just timing, blitzing a gap or shooting a gap. And you would see him sort of creep up, because I know this is another thing that we'll talk about, but when he was truly back in coverage. I mean, they would be like 25 yards deep from the line. Mm-hmm. It's like way back there. And the amount of space that he could cover. So you'd creep up, and so you could kind of tell something was going on. But then still, just the exact perfect timing with the snap count. An offensive lineman not able to even get a hand on him before he would get in the backfield and get a TFL or force a running back into somebody else's arms. Just really great instincts and timing for those run blitzes.
Yeah, and those running backs, they knew they were getting hit in the knee, but that's a great memory you have of that particular thing. I'd actually forgotten that. But Reed's timing to creep to the line of scrimmage exactly at the snap, I mean, he had as good or better as any three-point stance get-off in terms of that. And it appeared like he should be offsides, but one thing Ed Reed used to say about the punt team, being on the punt team, was that he got most of his blocks off the center. That if the center was futzing with the ball somehow, then he knew it was going. And it wouldn't surprise me if he was really watching the center to figure out when the ball is going to be snapped, or he'd figure out the opponent's cadence in a way that would get him into the backfield early. But remarkable instincts in that regard.
I heard a coach say this once, and I don't know that Ed Reed was doing this, but and I don't even know how practical it is, but it sounded cool in theory. So he talked about reaction time, right? When you're looking at the snap, you're talking about getting off the ball. And he gave this demonstration of how fast you can react to movement, right? The movement of the ball versus how fast you can react to the shadow of the ball moving. So when you don't actually see the ball, but you see the shadow, and he said your eye can recognize that quicker and react to that quicker than the actual movement of the ball in the center's hand. So he was teaching his guys to watch the shadow to time that, their get off.
That is freaking fascinating. Link me. If you've got that, I would love to watch that, Michael. Link me.
Yeah, it's a D-line coach at Florida State. It was one of these Nike Coach of the Year clinics. I have to go back and dig it up, like where he did it at. But he's the only guy I've ever heard talk about that. And he said he played in the NFL, and I can't remember his name now. But I want to say he played for the Rams at one point in time. And he said there was some pretty good defensive tackles there before he joined the team as a rookie. And he said that's what whoever that guy was, I have to go back and look it up, told him that's how he did it. Because he was like, how do you – because he could literally get his hands on the center before the center got the ball between his legs. And he's like, how do you do that? And he said, I'm not looking at the ball. I'm looking at the shadow of the ball, which is crazy.
There must be something there that light, dark, or something makes it easier.
He talked about something. He got into, like, you know, cognitive stuff about your eye and how it recognizes light and shadow. Like, he got pretty deep. But anyway, that's a huge diversion. But I just, you know, thinking about Ed's timing and, you know, his ability to kind of get a really good jump on the snap just sort of triggered that for me. Sorry, I don't want to take us too far.
No, it's okay. Wouldn't surprise me. Let's go back to 2004 for a minute, because 2004 had a really landmark presentation by NFL Films that I think a lot of people have seen. But if you hadn't, it's probably out there on YouTube. And I know it's probably out there also still on Game Pass, where they have some specific content. But the Game of the Week presentation for the 2004 game at the Meadowlands, I believe it was in November. The Ravens were 5-3 coming into the game. They left the game 6-3. But it's one of the most astounding things you'll ever see. It's a precursor of FX, where they did all mic'd up players and announcers for the radio of both teams from the ballpark and had no narration. And it doesn't seem funny to have no narration until you hear something that doesn't have narration. And this is just seamlessly put together. But the stuff on field is hilarious. There's two that involve Ed Reed directly. The first one I thought was interesting was he plays rock, paper, scissors with Will Demps to decide who's going to blitz at one point during the game. It's just hilarious. Very Ed. And the second one is Ed Reed triggered the comeback in the game. The Ravens are down 14-0, about to go down by 3 scores, whether it was a field goal or a touchdown. And Lamont Jordan, the ex-Maryland running back, rolled right on a halfback option and looked to the end zone. They switched over to Herm Edwards' mic at the time and said, no, don't throw it. That's Ed Reed. And he threw the ball. Sure enough, Reed picks the ball off in the end zone, brings it back 103 yards for a touchdown. Now, there was Will Demps actually had a holding call on it, a very ticky-tack holding call that deleted some yards, but Reed, if he had gotten the full yardage there, I believe would still be the all-time record holder for a single season interception return yards. So anyway, that record was broken, but he set that year at 358 yards. And certainly that particular thing. It was just a remarkable gift from NFL Films to do something that innovative. And then they really made something out of it and made that a regular category of content they brought with these on-field sounds.
Yeah, and that I love what, you know, sort of how that show developed and what it developed into, that FX shows. Those are awesome, because you do get to see this behind the scenes on the field stuff, and it's always kind of surprising just the kind of things that are actually going on between players and coaches during an NFL game. Like you rock, paper, scissors, you think, well, come on, I mean, the intensity, the pressure, and everything that's going on. And these guys are doing like some of the silliest things that you could possibly imagine. But no, I love it. But yeah, in terms of his return yards, I mean, it's when you're thinking back about his career and obviously just how great a player he was, sometimes I can spill over into a little hyperbole, but he might be one of the best open field players, not just defensive players. Offensive, but just one of the best open field players in terms of being in the open field in space with the ball in his hands and maneuvering through traffic, making guys miss, setting up guys to make guys miss. Just so good at that. You know, you couldn't tackle him, you know, once he was in the open field.
Yeah, he not only was it very difficult to tackle him, but he really understood how to use an array of blockers. And it wasn't one guy he was trying to figure out. That Miami interception, we're going to get to this a little later, but let's jump ahead and talk about it since we're on the topic. In 2008, in the playoff game, he had the interception. First of all, it's an over-the-shoulder interception. He makes the first guy miss. Got to have eyes in the back of his head to jump out of that little tackle from Cobbs on the back end. Goes all the way to the left side of the field from the defense's perspective. Okay, well, that gets all the offensive players, and then we got a lot of slow guys there to go along with a couple wide receivers and running backs. But you got a lot of slow guys on that field, then meandering over to that side of the pasture from their perspective. And then Reed cut it back, and he used this wall of blockers, and you saw incredible block by Nada, a big block to absolutely flatten Pennington by Suggs. He just hops over all the traffic and skips into the end zone. As soon as he does get in the end zone, he's clear, but somebody knocked the ball out of his hand and through the end zone. Of course, it was still a touchdown, but that play just had everything. It's a highlight that I wish we saw even more, and it really illustrated how Ed Reed could set up the whole field.
Yeah, he became a punt returner. You know, whenever he intercepted the ball, he became a punt returner, and, you know, probably one of the best. I mean, if those interception return yards are any indication, the best of all time at doing that. But yeah, just you described that perfectly. I mean, he orchestrated that whole thing and knew exactly how to get the field turned to get, you know, flipped in terms of getting guys on one side versus the other to get to where he needed to get to. So it's more than just the physical ability. You could see just, you know, steps ahead, you know, in his mind in terms of how he's processing what he needs to do and how he needs to get there. And the great ones, it's seamless. You know, right. They just make it look so easy.
There are many other examples of this from Ed's career, but the one other play I want to point out from 2004 was the strip sack of Mark Brunell that turned around that game in Washington. So the Ravens were trailing, I believe, 10-0 at the time, and he got a sack off the edge where he was not touched. He forced the fumble, but of course, Ed Reed, forcing the fumble is not enough. If you're a defensive lineman, maybe falling on it is enough. He picked it right up, avoids a guy on the sideline and running back, and runs and takes it to the house. It's just it's not the trifecta. It's the whatever fourfecta is that your horse racing people will know better than me. But unbelievable year in 2004, full of highlights, and just a damn shame that the Ravens were denied a playoff spot at the end of that year.
Yeah, that was a tough pill to swallow with such a dominant year by one player and you know, the defense overall, you know, still being really, really good. So it's tough to see that. But man, what a treat we were given with those teams, and we're not done. I mean, we're just scratching the surface.
So 2005, Reed had his worst season as a Raven. He played only 58% of the snaps, and he had just one interception. And a lot of people don't recall this was his first year at free safety. The big thing that happened that year, and there are a couple, but he missed his first Pro Bowl. But the big thing that happened was Rex Ryan arrived in Baltimore. And Ryan and Reed really, I think, understood each other a lot better than, say, Reed and Harbaugh later did in his early years. Ryan, for all intents and purposes, would have loved, he aspired to be Reed as a gambler on defense in terms of his play calls with the pass rush and what he was willing to try in coverage and whatnot. And Reed's instincts and his ability certainly played very well with that.
Yeah, it was, it reminds me, I've been doing some reading on some non-football stuff, and there's this term called match quality, right? They talk about like in labor market between employees and employers and, you know, what makes people stay at jobs. And so you think about the pairing of a player and a coach, you know, particularly this defensive coordinator, in terms of that perfect match quality between a coach's style and how he wants to call defense and what he wants his guys to do and how he wants them to play. And then Ed, just his natural playing style and the aggressiveness that he played with. And that I know we'll talk about this a little bit more probably later, but he wasn't a gambler. I mean, I think that's a misnomer with people. And I know you agree with that. This guy studied film intensely, studied players intensely. And so when he made choices on the field, it was based on that study or based on something he saw in that game. So did it always pan out? No. And I think that's why people sort of looked at his game. Like, oh, he takes his chance and it didn't work out. And then you've heard Harbaugh talk about him leaving cornerbacks out to dry because he was supposed to be over the top or helping them out. But when you see something based on study and preparation, and then it just doesn't pan out, you literally just get fooled, it doesn't make you a gambler. I mean, you're still doing something based on preparation. It just didn't turn out. But that match between him and Rex to say, hey, we're going to get this whole organized chaos thing going, and it's really going to leverage what Ed likes to do and the way Ed likes to play. It's a great fit. It was a great fit. Even though, interestingly enough, I'll throw this in real quick. Ed Reed said himself that he thought Dean Pease, he specifically compared Pease to Pagano and Rex, and actually thought that Dean Pease, he didn't use the word better or best, but he said, I liked him the most because he took what those other two guys were doing to another level. And it was more, not necessarily like on the field, but Ed was big into the player-coach relationship should be a partnership, right? It shouldn't be a dictatorship. And he felt Dean sort of took it, you know, Rex obviously had a reputation for being a player's coach, and so did Chuck Pagano. But he really felt like Dean Pease took that to another level in terms of taking his feedback, taking his input, and allowing him to sort of, you know, be a part of putting together game plans.
That's interesting. Now, he only played 1 year for Pease, so I wonder if he would have still had that same feeling if he'd played for more of the Pease era in Baltimore. But that's a very interesting point. Yeah. Well, let's see. Let's move on. We'll go to 2006. And Reed, again, is part of one of the strongest defenses in team history. So if you look back at that year, it was a team that had a great pass rush, had 60 sacks. Reed had 5 interceptions and was a big force on the back end. He was joined by Dwan Landry, who was a rookie that year, who also had 5 picks. Just a great year overall for that defense. Very few things really went wrong. They did have some issues in the secondary. A lot of this was the aggressiveness of Rex in terms of creating opportunities to beat the Ravens cornerbacks one-on-one. A lot of people don't know this, but McAllister had 15 penalties that year, which is an extraordinary number for a cornerback to have in a single season. But yeah, that was an interesting year there in terms of definitely doing a lot of things to gamble. Reed kept the Ravens in the game that we shall never talk about, which we'll talk about briefly right here. The game in the beginning of 2007 after the 2006 season where they lost to the Colts at home. And, you know, the path was clear for the Ravens to hold the AFC Championship game at home. And they lost that opportunity with a 15-6 loss. Reed had 2 picks in the game of Manning, including one where he lateraled the ball back into play for what should have been an opportunity for a return by McAllister that was whistled dead by an official on the sideline. And, of course, given the Ravens' offense at that time and just how weak McNair and Bowler were, that was a pretty serious blown call there. But that had the chance to be more than what it ended up being.
Yeah, I remember that game. More probably from the negative, from the offense's perspective. They just couldn't get anything going in that game. Just absolutely couldn't sustain drives, couldn't move the ball. I was It's an overstatement because I don't usually take losses that hard, but I was like despondent that game because it was like you've got this great defense. Ed's got two picks. They're playing well. You're doing this against Peyton Manning, and the offense can literally muster nothing.
No,
like, literally nothing.
They really couldn't. And I don't want to go too far afield on this, but the Colts had just had a 4-game losing streak on the road and were coming to Baltimore. I mean, it really, really hurt. And it hurt more than any game in Ravens history that the team has lost. The 2010 loss to the Steelers, the 2008 AFC Championship loss, even the Cundiff and Evans game did not hurt as much as having that 13-3 team lose that first playoff game. That just hurt too much.
No, I mean, that team... Well, anyway, like you said, let's move. Let's bury that one. Bury the ball. We'll move on.
So 2007, the entire Ravens cornerback core went down, and Reed played all but three snaps the entire year. But to give you an idea, the Ravens were playing a street corner at the end of the year, Willie Gaston. And believe me, by December in the NFL, there is no one available on the street at cornerback. If you're short a cornerback at that point, you can't trade for one. So you can't, no other team's corner is available. You can try and filter through the practice squads of other teams, but they've already been picked over pretty cleanly because cornerbacks get injured a lot. And there was nobody left. And Willie Gaston, a corner off the street, was somebody they had in there playing. McNair was fading. He was injured. The Ravens returned to Kyle Bowler in their desperation to start down the stretch. And then that really led to the decision under no uncertain terms that they'd move forward and draft a quarterback in 2008, which they did. A 4-2 start was capped off by a 9-game losing streak that left the team 5-11 for the year. And I wouldn't say Reed himself was particularly terrible, but it was very hard for Reed to be Reed when the rest of the team is falling apart like that. And you'd probably say pretty safely that Reed benefited from the defenses he played on. And the 2007 season shows a little bit of why that was true.
Yeah, I think you've tweeted about that season before. Was that the secondary of dying men?
That's exactly what I called it. Yes, sir.
That's the 2000 season. And no, that's a great point. I mean, when you play, well, look, I should just back up a step. I mean, if any secondary player plays on a defense with Ray Lewis, Haloti Ngata, Terrell Suggs, you're going to be better, right? You're going to be better in the secondary. But even with those guys, and even if you look at the other sort of components of the defense, his style of play, we've talked about a little bit already, really did lend itself to other guys being at least competent, if not better than competent, right? Mm-hmm. But once you get down to the kinds of guys that they were playing in 2007, then that style can almost become a hindrance and almost a detriment sometimes, because these guys are not what you would consider replacement level at that point. They're right. Below replacement level. And so, you know, his sort of aggressive approach could almost kind of backfire in that situation. But look, I mean, what are you going to do, right, when you have that rash of people getting hurt at a particular position? I mean, what are you going to do?
Oh, the season was certainly lost. So any quote-unquote gambling that Ed Reed did in 2007 didn't cost him much. Got him a little bit higher draft pick. They used that draft pick, of course, to get Joe Flacco and then Ray Rice in the second round that year. Reed in 2008 had one of the greatest defensive seasons of all time. I thought he certainly should have been the defensive player of the year that year. He was outstanding. And a lot of people don't remember that it didn't start off quite as gaudy from a statistics point of view. He had one interception in the first 10 games. But then through the playoffs, which was another 9 games, he had 5 multi-pick games, all 2. The rest of the way. And 5 multi-pick games, by the way, is the record for any individual season. Mm-hmm. In fact, I believe 4 is, but 5 is, including the playoffs. And, you know, we talked about the return at Miami. I remember hearing one former player watch him and say, he's just a center fielder. And my response to that is just, what the hell does that mean?
If he's just the center fielder, he's a Hall of Famer in baseball as well, because that's an understatement if there ever was one. I mean, he was so much more than that. I mean, look, there are coaches, and I think people, you know, who maybe can't remember some of these earlier Ed Reed memories, probably remember this. Greg Williams, who was the defensive coordinator in Cincinnati, Cleveland last year, maybe a year before that, right? And even in Washington, so people might remember some of his other stops. And they, you know, people would get on him about how deep he played his safety, right? I remember they had a rookie back there. Was it Jabril Peppers? Yeah, out of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And he played like 25 or 30 yards back. And people would call it like the halo defense and, you know, all these gripes and complaints. He's so far from the play. He's not even involved. What's the point? Well, Ed Reed played from that position regularly and was involved in many, many plays, right? He could get to any place on the field from that position. And often, you know, it was very contrived. You know, he's literally setting quarterbacks up by playing from that depth, right? To think, well, there's no way this guy's going to be able to break on this particular throw or get this particular route. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you see him backing up like, okay, he's going to go back even deeper. And then you snap the ball and he breaks at like a 90 degree angle, right? To exactly where the ball is going. So yeah, anybody who thinks just a center fielder was what made him who he was doesn't get it, right? They're just missing the point, because other coaches have tried to play guys in that way at that depth, and it doesn't work. It takes a very special player to do that.
Well, there were heat maps produced with Earl Thomas last year that showed how much of an effect he had on where the throws went. But believe me, Reed had that same impact. And I know you know this, I'm not saying for you to believe me, but he had that same impact on the opposing quarterback. And the best evidence we can show is Tom Brady's armband, fine 20 on every play. Yep. And he was very cognizant of what was happening with Ed Reed. You ask Peyton Manning to tell him to tell the greatest Ed Reed story, he'll tell you about the time he deked him to an interception 30 yards from where the ball was going by just turning in the opposite direction. Yep. And then without looking back at Manning, breaking exactly on the ball where it was going to be thrown. So I really, whenever I hear that, I'm like, you're not really watching this, are you? You know, in terms of being just a center fielder, I think more than any safety who's ever played the game, he was able to read the good potential route tree options that each receiver had from various tells they had, leverage, how their feet were, however they were looking. Also, probably their tendencies that he'd seen from film before, but he really understood what were the most likely routes they would run, and he would often gamble on one. And hey, that's what free safeties do. You're not always just trying to have a reactive bracket coverage, although sometimes that works. A lot of the time, you just want to break on the football, take a chance, and maybe you get a pick.
Yep, and he's said this himself, so I'm not telling tales out of school. He said, you know, players, you know, would he be at a Pro Bowl or whatever, would come up to him and say, hey, man, how can I learn to do what you do? Or even when he kind of, you know, took a little short coaching stint there with Rex up in Buffalo. It's like, how can I learn to do what you do? I want to do what you do. He said, I can't teach reps. I can't teach experience. You know, I've done this thousands upon thousands of times, you know? So, yeah, you're right. Whoever's, you know, sort of dumbing it down to that level, they're watching highlights and not seeing the whole impact that this guy had.
Right. Okay, well, let's move on. 2009, it was a year with only three interceptions in the first of the two Madison years at defensive coordinator. So Madison, a guy with a reputation for being kind of conservative in this town as a defensive coordinator, but the Raven defenses were good in those years. Reed missed four games in 2009. I would argue the 2009 team, despite their 9-7 record, was the best of the early Harbaugh era. That team certainly had the best offensive line. And did they also have other components? But they had Orr correctly placed at right tackle and having his best year. In the middle, they had the three future and current Pro Bowlers in Yanda, Burke, and Grubbs. And then on the left side, they had Jared Gaither, who was a hell of a left tackle in 2009. So they really did have a great offensive line then. And unfortunately, gagged away a lot of their chance, went 9-7, still made the playoffs, went to New England, beat the crap out of them in that 33-14 game where it was over in the first quarter. Reed played a significant part in that first quarter. He had a PD to knock down a pass intended for Randy Moss. And then he had an interception on a deflected ball along the left sideline that really closed out that scoring. Actually, it set up the third touchdown also. So, you know, Reed had a great year again in 2009, but it wasn't as great stat-wise as it had been. He went to his fifth Pro Bowl. Had two more interceptions in the playoffs, though, and two interceptions in the playoffs meant intercept Brady, intercept Manning.
Yeah, I remember that Patriots game, and I think, at least for me, it was such a dominant performance that it was maybe the first game, or at least maybe the beginning of sort of being able to knock that mystique off the Patriots. Like, you can't mm-hmm. go up to Foxborough and win. Nobody beats them up in Foxborough. And then you could see for years after that, whenever you get into the playoffs and whenever there's talk about the various teams in the AFC and everything's got to go through New England, almost to a man, every commentator would say, well, the Ravens aren't scared of going up to Foxborough and playing the Patriots up there. And the Patriots actually, you know, are very respectful of all the teams who they might have to face. That's the team, you know, that they're probably the most worried about. And obviously, Ed, you mentioned Tom Brady's wristband, and there have been sort of the behind the scenes clips with Belichick and Brady, like, sitting down together. And, you know, Belichick just, like, you know, mm-hmm. like a fanboy over Ed Reed, how great he was and how he could do all of these amazing things. So they were very well aware of just how special Ed was. If he was a center fielder, he had them fooled.
Yeah. Well, there you go. And I agree with that. That's something certainly I think the Patriots fans have been respectful about that. They'll talk crap all day long about beating Indianapolis or Pittsburgh at home, but they have lost two out of four playoff games to the Ravens. The other two, they won them by the skin of their teeth, and they probably shouldn't have won either of those. So anyway, it's certainly a place where the Ravens hadn't been afraid to play. So let's move forward into 2011 now. Chuck Pagano takes over as the defensive coordinator. The Ravens reach the AFC Championship game after Ed Reed's interception sealed the win against the Texans in that divisional game in Baltimore. That's kind of a forgotten playoff game, I think, for a lot of people. A not dominant 20-13 win over the Texans with T.J. Yates at quarterback. But it's Reed hauling in a ball intended for, I forget, I don't think it was Andre Johnson, because it was Lardarius Webb shut down Andre Johnson in that game. But Ed Reed hauled in a ball that was thrown down to the goal line, which for what could have been the tying score in the waning seconds, and that put the game away.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that season gets only remembered for the Lee Evans play, right? It's like everything else gets sort of overshadowed by that one play. But that, you know, as heartbreaking as that was, as deflating as it was, it really did kind of set the scene for the next season. I can remember that Ray Lewis speech right in the locker room afterwards. I think somebody played it or wrote up, you know, how he told them. He said, look, this is the beginning, right? Don't look at this as the end. This is the beginning. Next year, we're going to come back and we're going to win this thing. Next year, you know, I don't want any guy in this locker room dropping his head right over what happened here, because this is the beginning and not the end, you know, and only the way that Ray could, you know, very pastoral, and he gets everybody fired up. But it really did kind of set the stage. And you could say, well, look, teams always do that, right? After a bit, yeah, we're going to come back next year and we're going to win the Super Bowl. But they actually did it. pretty rare, I think.
Right. We'll come back to the Super Bowl just one second, because in 2011, there was talk by now, by the way, that Reed would retire every year. You talk about it in the offseason, and it got to be kind of a tiresome thing where they would every year have to reset a 2-year deal for him with a signing bonus to kind of get him to hang around. And that's I understand the finances of the game and why it was important for Reed to get that. And the Ravens certainly didn't overpay, given what they did end up paying for. But in 2011, I really thought he might retire after that year. And in fact, right before the final drive that was set up, you know, the Flacco drove him down the field, Flacco to Bolden, then Flacco to Evans, and the ball was stripped by Sterling Moore. And also you had Cundiff's missed kick right after that. But the play that set up that drive was a third and whatever play where Ed Reed got a PD against Aaron Hernandez. And great play to start with. And he went to pick up the ball. And I thought, oh shit, what does that mean? Is he taking that ball because he knows that's his last PD as a player here? And he's walking off the field with it. I'm like, uh-oh, this isn't good. And then he flicked the ball away at the last minute. And I go,
Yeah, he's just caught up in the emotion of it all. But no, that's a very good point. I do kind of remember those now, where there was always that feeling that this could be the last year, and particularly after the way that game ended. If you ever thought this really is the one, that had to be the one. But thankfully, you're right. They just flipped that ball away, and that had to be a sigh of relief for you and other Ravens fans watching that.
There you go. So anyway, 2012 came around, finished his career with a good season, interception Super Bowl 47 to cap things off. There's two things about that. One thing about that particular interception, which was fairly common in Ed's career, is that Ed really understood bracket coverage and how to be on the back end, where if there was any sort of a mistake with the throw, he was going to be in a position to make the pick. And this was one of these plays where he's 5 or 6 yards behind the receiver, but perfectly lined up to take to either work with a deflection or collect an overthrow, which I believe was just a plain overthrow from Kaepernick on that play. But anyway, he was remarkable at that. And finished with it. That was his ninth interception in 15 career postseason games, which ties the all-time record. Of course, the other two guys played a lot more postseason games to get there.
Yeah, he told some pretty interesting stories about that game. He was on one of the local podcasts, the team podcast, the Lounge podcast, with Ryan Mink and Garrett Downing. And he said he actually played that game with two torn MCLs. That he tore his right and left MCL in the first quarter. So he tore it in the right knee and the left knee. And he said it was diagnosed. And he said, go check it out. He said, it's on the books. You know, that's I don't know how you would ever get this information from the draft.
Yes.
But he says, you know, it's diagnosed. But he said there was no way that he was coming out of that game. Right. There was no way in the world he was coming out of the game. And he told another story. And I got to make sure I got this one right. If it wasn't the play, the last play where Jimmy was against Crabtree and the
yes.
no pass interference, clearly no pass interference. I think we can all agree on that. If it wasn't that play, it was a play before where Ed said that he blitzed, I think. I think he rushed Kaepernick or did something, and he wasn't supposed to. he said that the design of the play was for him to sort of be in the back and sort of help out there, but he saw where he saw something. And he decided to just blitz and yeah. And so again, just another example of him, you know, believing what he saw, what he came across in his preparation. But the stories about the MCLs, I had never heard that before. And this, you know, it's what he said himself. So if that's accurate, that's even more great, because he said he should have had more interceptions. That's how it came up, because they brought up the fact that he had one, and he said, I should have had more, but you know, I tore my MCLs.
It's a great game. The way I recall the story you're telling, and I don't want to micro this, but is that he was supposed to blitz on that final play, but he decided instead that the pass was definitely going to Crabtree, and he ran over there. And he says, if you look at that throw, had it been on target, either me or Jimmy would have picked it off, because we had him. Yeah. Yeah. There's only one thing. I had some other comments about his career, but I think we've kind of fit this into the timeline display of this. But I did want to come up with this one more thing, because Ed Reed's interception rate, I don't think, is appreciated on the level it is. Now, Ed Reed comes in with a high career interception total, so we know that. But he is, even when you include the playoffs and bump him to 73 career interceptions, Ed Reed is still only third on the all-time NFL list, behind Paul Krause, Emlyn Tunnell, and then Rod Woodson's at 72, Ronnie Lott's at 72, and you have Lane and Riley at 68, Charles Woodson at 66, Darren Sharper 65, and then Brown and LeBeau at 62. Here's the point I want to make about this. Relative to his era, Ed Reed's position is, let's say, somewhat different when you refactor relative to the overall interception rate that occurred from 1945 to 2016. So let me explain that a little further, because I think I just did a crap job on that. From 1945 to 2016, per team, per game, there were 1.234 interceptions. Okay, when Ed Reed was getting his big interception totals, there were only about between 0.9 and slightly over 1 interceptions per team per game. So when you adjust Ed Reed's interceptions to be for that year. How much is that for a typical NFL season between 1945 and 2016? Reed's total jumps to, and that's adjusted interceptions here. Let me get this number for you. Well, Reed's, because I adjusted it to the Reed era, is 73. But if you adjust it to the NFL average, it's 91 he jumps to, which is significantly more and is the highest total of all time by 9. The next highest is Charles Woodson at 82.5 and Rod Woodson at 81.4. But that's not the end of it, because you really then need to look at his interceptions per 16 games played to make sure the old-timers in particular are being treated fairly in terms of interceptions per game when they play a shorter year. The 12-game season in the NFL was the standard for a long time, then the 14, and now it's 16. But looking back to that, at the interceptions per game, playoffs included now, we're going to go through the list. We're going to go through all the players here really quickly. But we see that Brown had 4.11 interceptions per 16. LeBeau, 4.41. And these are all the guys in the top 10 of the all-time interception list. Riley, 455. Tunnel, 468. He was the interception leader for many years, but did it in an era with many more interceptions. Lane, 4.73. Paul Krause, who was the interception leader also for a long time, in fact, still is 4.79 interceptions per 16 games. Charles Woodson, modern era guy, 4.87 interceptions per 16 games. Rod Woodson, 5.05. Ronnie Lott, 5.37. Darren Sharper, 5.64. And Ed Reed, 7.67 interceptions per 16 games. So to put it this way, his interception total is 36% higher on a per-game basis than the next highest player in NFL history.
And I totally agree. I definitely don't think it's appreciated that way. And for those Steelers and Eagles fans who might be listening, I think when you lay it out that way, I don't know if there's any other case to be made, at least in terms of interceptions. I mean, that's a pretty significant difference adjusted for era and, you know, sort of the interception rates for a particular era. That's amazing. Actually, I had no idea that. I mean, we talked about this a little bit, and you definitely said that, you know, there was a difference, but I hadn't heard the exact number until right now. I mean, that's very, very surprising.
Yeah, the one guy who's off to a pretty good start, and he hasn't kept it up already, is Marcus Peters. Off to a great start, but that's a lot of times that'll happen. A guy in his first two or three years, it's kind of like there's a lot of more 400 hitters at the end of April than there are at the end of the season. So
yeah, and I guess, you know, in this era too, I mean, I guess people are expecting maybe, you know, somebody will kind of continue and sort of, because, you know, teams are throwing it around so much more now. But I don't know if you ever will see that again. I mean, a number at that. Every time you say that, then of course, if you live, you know, long enough, or even if you don't, you know, as time passes by, there will be somebody. But I don't know. That sounds like a really hard number to beat. And I know it's not something that, you know, is going to be reflected in an official stat or anything like that, but it's an important one for perspective.
Yeah, it's definitely an outlier in terms of one. I want to read a few memories that people had of Ed Reed from the mailbag here. So let's do that real quick. The strip sack that recovered from the TD is one. Zach Weinberg also had that one from that Washington game. Let's see. This is a good one. Primetime game versus Mark Sanchez, where Webb had a pick six in the red zone at a critical moment of the game. I'm not remembering this. I do remember Webb having a pick of Mark Sanchez and taking it to the house. But Reed was screaming something to Webb right before the snap. That's a good memory there. This is some good stuff. We're going to get some memories. There's a lot of ones we've already talked about today. We're going to try and just credit people for giving them to us, but we can't go over every single one. We had a lot of people talking about the 64-yard return against Miami. Anyway, I don't think we have time to go through all this. I think we have covered a lot of them already, but what a career. I mean, we could talk, I'm sure, for another hour about individual highlights that he had, or that great video, if you haven't seen it, that the Ravens produced with every single one of his interceptions. It's just fantastic. Really worth the watch. It's about 10 minutes long, and you see every one.
I retweeted that, and I said, just think about what you're watching here for a minute. A 9+ minute video of nothing but interceptions, right? It doesn't take into account any other great plays or highlight, you know, real plays that he made throughout his career, which there were many. Yeah. Literally just 9 minutes of interceptions. I mean, it's almost unthinkable.
Yeah, it didn't even have the returns on most of them. I did have some of the touchdowns that included all of the return yardage because they were looking for it. But wow, what it's definitely worth the watch. A wonderfully produced Ravens video there.
Yes, very well done.
All right. Oh, Michael, thanks for doing this impromptu to make sure we paid the proper respects to a player I know we both loved and just marveled at his career. I don't think there are too many Ravens fans who just don't gush over Ed Reed's accomplishments when they talk about it. There are some people they'll complain a little bit about what happened, or maybe they'll even complain about him as a tackler in the later years, which you're really nitpicking at that point. Yep. But I think most people just tend to gush over the plays that they'll remember about him. I'm sure he'll be a player we all remember. What do you think about a statue for Ed Reed?
Yeah, there's been some talk about that lately, hasn't there? It's interesting because I've heard some sentiment recently, and some of it maybe is just the recency bias thing because he's the latest guy of the greats, right? Ray Lewis and Ed Reed, mm-hmm. to be enshrined. And, you know, a lot of talk about, hey, maybe Ed is our favorite player, right? Maybe Ed is the favorite Raven of all time. And so no matter how you come down on that, you certainly can probably agree that he's right there. You know, you hear him talk about the whole Batman and Robin comparison to him and Ray, and he's like, who's to say I'm not Batman? So, it's interesting. I don't know. I mean, I probably would be okay with it. He's certainly deserving. I mean, I don't think there's any question of that. He said his career is certainly deserving of it. But I guess there was the sort of argument out there. So like, okay, well, then do you build a statue of J.O.? Do you for Jonathan Ogden too? I mean, where do you just have like a statue garden at some point? And you just have like all of these statues of all these great. And I said, well, look, it's not going to get to that point, right? They're not going to have 5 or 6 different statues out there. There's probably 3 or 4, and then that's probably it.
Well, I think, you know, they probably have number 4 on the way, and they might have number 5 on the way. We'll see if it goes. But, you know, obviously they've got a United statue, and I'm not even counting that in the group. But you got 4 entrances, and Ray and Unitas have 1 set. Go ahead, put Ed Reed at 1 entrance. Put J.O. at an entrance, and then Terrell Suggs is going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. Go ahead and put him at 1 also.
That's right. I don't know how I could have left Suggs out.
Well, and then I guess the next question is, I don't really believe Marshall Yanda is going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer unless he plays for significantly longer. But is it possible Justin Tucker could be a first ballot Hall of Famer at some point in the future? You know, I'm not saying it's the only way to go, but I've got no problem at all spending Bisciotti's money on additional statues.
Sure, he appreciates the ease at which you want to spend his money. I can't imagine he would have any problem with that. I mean, if you were going to do it for a guy, he's the guy that you're going to do it for. And then, like you said, I didn't think about the 4 different entrances. I mean, it sort of makes sense, right? You could do it that way and then figure out what you want to do with Suggs. But I'd be perfectly fine with it. And if we could get that same look on his statue that he got from the bust, we could just get the head and they could do whatever they want with the uniform and the body. If we get that same look, that would be awesome.
Yeah, it'd be a great statue, that's for sure. I would like a in uniform, because I think there are so many great in motion plays from Ed that are definable and remind you of a moment. Unlike Ray, who, you know, they've got him dancing, coming out of the tunnel effectively, or, you know, shouting after a play. That's fine. That's the way we think of Ray more often, but there isn't this particular play of it. Maybe him taking the ball away from Eddie George that would be in that same class. Anyway, appreciate your time, Michael, and we'll come back and we'll be doing some shows coming up this week after the first exhibition game to talk about.
Yeah, preseason's ramping up. I'm excited.
Who's the player? Just before we log off here, who's the player you're most excited to see on Thursday night?
Well, I guess I know I'm supposed to pick one, but this guy's not going to play, I don't think. Hollywood Brown's not going to play, so I'm not going to pick him. He would be the guy I was most excited to see, but I don't believe that he's going to play. So for me, I'm probably going to go, I'll stay on offense. I want to go on defense, but I'll stay on offense, and I'll go Miles Boykin just because, yeah. You know, there's been all of the reports and certainly, you know, he has made plays and has played well in practice, but now let's see it in a game. And again, it's a preseason game and it's the first preseason game, and people will say, well, he's doing it against guys who aren't even going to be in the league. That's okay. There's a progression to this, right? You have to do it in mini camp, then OTA, then practices, then preseason. So as long as you see this continual performance, then I'm totally fine with that. And I think that's exactly the way that you want it to happen. So I'll go with Boykin.
Okay. I got two players that I'm excited to see how they're different this year. And the first is Jaleel Scott on offense, because he's been a lot better, in camp this year so far than where he's been last year. That's for sure. And the other on defense, I do want to see something from Jalen Ferguson. So he's a guy I'd pick, but Deshaun Elliott is the guy. They need to find out if he can play on the back end, if he's the answer there for the next few years as another safety who can play back.
Two good picks. Both of those guys.
You get a defender if you want.
Okay. That's nice. Thank you. I get a bonus pick. I'm going to throw in another defender. All right. I'm going to cheat again. Tim Williams, Tyus Bowser.
Okay. You got that. Both,
yeah. I'm sorry. I probably stole one there. But both guys going into year three. Is mm-hmm. that right for both guys? And, you know, I think Joe Cullen said it, right? The clock is ticking.
Yep.
You know, we gotta see it. We gotta see it now. So by all accounts, Bowser has had a good camp. I think he's coming off what Harbaugh said was his best week of practice, maybe ever as a Raven, not just this year. Take that for what it's worth. But let's see what happens, you know, in these games. It's time. Like Coach Cullen said, the clock is ticking.
Yeah, he had a pressure today. It looked good. So I'm excited to see him. Big interception with the return on Monday against the Jags. So all right, Michael, we'll talk to you again on probably Friday of this week to talk some defense or some offense. We'll decide which one we're going to do first, and hope you guys will tune in again after that.
Right. Sounds good. Thanks, Ken.
Introducing the Lowe's List for Innovation. While our aisles are filled with innovative products, we've selected our favorites just for you. Like the exclusive Whirlpool washer with industry-first 2-in-1 removable agitator. We love this washer because you can customize any load. And with other smart features to streamline your laundry routine, this product is a must-have for families. Shop the full Lowe's List of top picks at Lowe's.com. Lowe's, home to any budget, home to any possibility. U.S. only.
Some cars are comfy on the inside, but don't have power on the outside. And some cars have the horsepower, but none of the comfort. I used to think there weren't any cars that were the total package. But that all changed when I got my Honda SUV. It's rugged and sophisticated. And right now, Honda has deals on the entire Honda SUV lineup. CR-V, HR-V, Pilot, Passport, you name it. So if you're looking for a car that's the total package, the only place you'll find it is at your local Honda dealer. Hurry before they're all gone.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.